Disc 4.
Not for me. Never too corny. Never too romantic. That won't happen, Alex. Christine smiled. I loved to see her like this. Her eyes twinkled and danced. I sometimes get lost in her eyes, fall into the deep pools. All that good stuff that people yearn for, but few seem to get nowadays, which is sad. She stared back, and my fingers lightly caressed her cheek. Then I held her under her chin. Stardust was playing. It's one of my favorite songs, even under ordinary circumstances. I wondered if Hilton and Efrain were playing the tune for us, and when I looked at him, Hilton gave me a sly wink. We moved closer together and danced in place. I could feel her heart beating, feel it right up against my chest. We must have stayed like that for 10 or 15 minutes. No one at the bar seemed to notice. No one bothered us, offered to refill our drinks, or escort us to our table. I guess they understood.
I really like Kincaid's, Christine whispered. But you know what? I'd rather be home with you tonight. Someplace a little more private. I'll make you eggs, whatever you'd like. Is that all right? Do you mind?
No, I don't mind at all. That's a perfect idea. Let's go. I paid our bar bill and made my regrets about the dinner reservation. Then we went to Christine's.
We'll start with dessert, she said, and smiled wickedly.
I like that about her, too.
Chapter 39. I had been waiting a long time to be in love again, but this was worth it and then some. I grabbed hold of Christine as soon as we were inside her house. My hands began to trace her waist, her hips. They played over her breasts, her shoulders, then touched the delicate bones of her face. We like to do this slowly. No need to rush. I kissed her lips, then gently scratched her back and shoulders. I pulled her closer, closer.
You have the gentlest touch, she whispered against my cheek. I could do this all night. Be just like this. You want some wine? Anything? I'll give you anything I have.
I love you, I told her, still lovingly scratching her lower back. We will do this forever. I have no doubt of it.
I love you so much, she said.
Then I heard her breath softly catch.
So please, try to be careful, Alex. At work?
Okay, I will. But not tonight, I said. Christine smiled.
Not tonight. Tonight you can live dangerously. We both will.
You are handsome and debonair for a policeman. Or even for an international jewel thief. I swept her up and carried her down the hall to the bedroom.
Strong, too, she said.
She flicked on a hall lamp as we passed. It was just enough light to see where we were going. How about a trip somewhere, I said. I need to get away.
That sounds good. Yes, before school starts. Anywhere. Take me away from all this.
Her room smelled of fresh flowers. There were pink and red roses on the nightstand. She has a passion for flowers and gardening.
You planned this all along, didn't you? I said.
You did. This is entrapment, you sly girl.
I was thinking about it all day, she confessed, and sighed contentedly. I thought about being with you all day. In my office, in the hallways, the schoolyard, and then in my car on the way to the restaurant. I've been having erotic daydreams about you all day.
I hope I can live up to them.
You will. No doubt about it.
I took off her black silk blouse in one sweeping motion. I put my mouth to a breast, pulling at it through her demi-bra. She was wearing a brushed leather skirt, and I didn't take it off, just slowly pushed it up. I knelt and kissed her ankles, the tops of her feet.
then slowly came up her long legs. She massaged my neck, my back and shoulders.
"You are dangerous tonight," she said. "That's a good thing."
"Sexual healing."
"Please. Heal me all over, doctor."
She bit down hard into my shoulder, then even harder into the side of my neck. We were both breathing fast. She moved against me, then opened her legs for me. I moved inside her. She felt incredibly warm. The bedsprings began to sing, and the headboard rocked into the wall. She pushed her hair to one side behind an ear. I love the way she does that.
"You feel so good. Oh, Alex, don't stop. Don't stop. Don't stop," she whispered.
I did as I was told and loved every moment, every movement we made together. And I even wondered for a second if we had made a baby.
Chapter 40. Much later that night, we rustled up some eggs with Vidalia onions and cheddar and mozzarella cheeses, and opened a nice bottle of Pinot Noir. Then I started a fire in August with the air conditioner turned up high. We sat in front of the fire, laughed and talked, and planned a quick trip away from Washington. We settled on Bermuda, and Christine asked if we could bring Nana and the kids. I felt as if my life were changing fast, going to a new good place. If only I could get lucky and catch the weasel somehow. That could be the perfect ending to my career with the Metro Police. I went home to Fifth Street late and got in just before 3. I didn't want Damon and Janny to wake up in the morning and not find me there. I was up by 8 o'clock the next morning, bounding downstairs to the delectable smells of fresh coffee and Nana's world-famous sticky buns. The terrible twosome was just about ready to dash off to the Sojourner Truth School, where they were taking morning advanced classes. They looked like a pair of shiny angels. I didn't get to feel this good very often, so I was going all the way with it.
"How was your date last night, Daddy?"
Janny said, making her biggest goo-goo eyes at me. "Who said I had a big date?" I made room for her on my knee. She ate a bite of the humongous sweet bun Nana had set on my plate.
"Let's just say a little birdie told me," she chirped.
"Uh-huh. Little birdie makes good sticky buns," I said. "My date was pretty good. How was yours? You had a date, right? Didn't sit home alone, did you?"
"Your date was pretty good? You came home with the milkman."
Janny laughed out loud. Damon was giggling, too. She can get us all going when she wants to. She's been that way since she was a baby.
"Janny Cross,"
Nana said, but she let it go. There was no use trying to make Janny act like a typical 7-year-old at this point. She was too bright, too outspoken, too full of life and fun. Besides, we have a philosophy as a family. He or she who laughs, lasts.
"How come you two don't live together first?" Janny asked. "That's what they all do in the movies and on TV."
I found myself grinning and starting to frown at the same time. "Don't get me going on the silly stuff they do on TV and in the movies, little girl. They always get it wrong. Christine and I are going to get married soon, and then we'll all live together."
"You asked her?"
they all exclaimed. "I did."
"And she said yes?"
"Why do you all look so surprised? Of course she said yes. Who could resist being a part of this family?"
"Hooray!"
Janny whooped loudly. I could tell she meant it from the bottom of her little heart.
"Hooray!" echoed Nana. "Thank God, oh, thank God."
"I agree," Damon piped in. "It's time we had a more normal life around here." Everybody was congratulating me for several minutes until Janny finally said,
"I have to go to school now, Papa. I wouldn't want to disappoint Mrs. Johnson by being late now, would I? Here's your morning newspaper."
Janny handed me the Washington Post, and my heart jumped a little in my chest. This was a good day indeed. I saw Zachary Taylor's story at the bottom right of the front page. It wasn't the banner headline it deserved to be, but he'd gotten the story on page 1. Potential scandal over unsolved murders in Southeast D.C. Possible racial bias seen in police activity.
"Potential scandal indeed," Nana said,
and squeegeed her lower face.
Genocide always is, isn't it?
Chapter 41. I entered the station house at around 8, and Chief Pittman's assistant lackey came scurrying up to me.
Old Fred Cook had been a bad detective once, and he now was an equally bad and devious administrator, but he was as smooth a butt-kisser as could be found in the department or anywhere else in Washington.
The chief of detectives wants to see you in his office post-haste.
It's important, Fred told me. Better move it.
I nodded at him and tried to keep my good mood intact.
Of course it is. He's the chief of detectives.
You have any helpful hints for me, Fred? You happen to know what this is about? What I should expect?
It's a big deal, said Cook, unhelpful and happy about it.
That's all I can tell you, Alex.
He walked away, leaving me hanging. I could feel bile rising in my throat. My good mood had already deserted me. I walked down the creaking hardwood floors of the hallway to the jefe's office. I had no idea what to expect, but I sure wasn't prepared for what I found. I immediately thought about what Damon had said that morning. It's time we had a normal life around here. Samson was seated inside the chief's office. Rakeem Powell and Jerome Thurman were both in there, too.
Come in, Dr. Cross.
Chief Pittman beckoned with an outstretched hand.
Please come in. We've been waiting for you to arrive.
What is this? I said, pulling up a chair next to Samson's and whispering in his ear.
Don't know yet, but it's not too good, he said. The jefe hasn't said word one to us. Looks like the canary who ate the cat, though.
Pittman came around in front of his desk and leaned his ample buttocks back against it. He seemed particularly full of himself and bullshit this morning. His mousy gray hair was plastered back and looked like a helmet on his bullet head.
I can tell you what you want to know, Detective Cross, he said. In fact, I didn't want to tell these other detectives until you got here. As of this morning, Detectives Sampson, Thurman, and Powell have been suspended from active duty. They have been working on cases outside the auspices of this department. Evidence is still being gathered about the full extent of these activities, and also, if any other detectives were involved.
I started to speak up, but Sampson grabbed my arm hard.
Be cool, Alex.
Pittman looked at the three of them.
Detective Sampson, Thurman, Powell, you can go. Your union representative has been informed of the situation. You have questions or issues with my decision? Inform your representative.
Samson's mouth was set hard. He didn't say a word to the jefe, though. He got up and left the office. Thurman and Powell trailed close behind him. Neither of them spoke to Pittman either. The three of them were hard-working, dedicated detectives, and I couldn't stand to watch this happen.
I wondered why the jefe had spared me so far.
I also wondered why Sean Moore wasn't there. The cynical answer was that Pittman wanted to set us against one another, to make us believe that Sean had spoken against us. Pittman reached across his desk and picked up a folded copy of the Washington Post.
You happen to see this article today? Bottom right?
He pushed the newspaper toward me. I had to catch the paper to keep it from falling to the floor.
Scandal over unsolved murders in Southeast, I said.
Yes, I did. I read it at home.
I'll bet you did. Mr. Taylor of the Post quotes unidentified sources in the police department. You have anything to do with the article?
Pittman asked and stared hard at me.
Why would I want to talk to the Washington Post? I asked a question in answer to his. I told you about the problem in Southeast. I think a repeat killer may be working there. Why go any farther with it than that? Suspending those detectives sure won't help solve the problem, especially if this sicko is approaching rage, which I believe he is.
I don't buy this serial killer story. I don't see any pattern that's consistent. No one else does but you.
Pittman shook his head and frowned. He was hot, angry, trying to control himself. He reached out his hand toward me again. His fingers were like uncooked sausages. He lowered his voice almost to a whisper.
I'd like to fuck you over good, and I will. But for now, it wouldn't be expedient to pull you off the Odenkirk homicide. It wouldn't look good, and I suspect it would end up in the Post, too. I look forward to your daily reports on the so-called John Doe case. You know, it is time you got some of those unsolved murders off the books. You'll report directly to me on this. I'm going to be all over you, Cross. Any questions?
I quickly left Chief Pittman's office before I hit him. Chapter 42.
Samson Thurman and Rakeem Powell had already left the building by the time I got out of the jefe's office. I felt as if I could easily go postal. I nearly walked back inside Pittman's office and wiped up the floor with him. I went to my desk and thought about what to do next, tried to calm myself down before I did anything rash and stupid. I thought about my responsibilities to the people in Southeast, and that helped me. Still, I almost went back after Pittman. I called Christine and let out some steam. Then, on the spur of the moment, I asked if she could get away for our long weekend, possibly starting on Thursday night. Christine said that she could go. I went and filled out a vacation form and left it on Fred Cook's desk. It was the last thing he and Pittman would expect from me. But I'd already decided the best thing would be to get away from here, cool down, then figure out a plan to move forward. As I headed out of the building, another detective stopped me. "They're over at Hart's Bar," he said. "Samson said to tell you they reserved a seat for you." Hart's is a very seedy, very popular gin mill on 2nd Street. It isn't a cop's bar, which is why some of us like it. It was 11 in the morning, and the barroom was already crowded, lively, even friendly. "Here he is!" Jerome Thurman saluted me with a half-full beer mug as I walked inside. Half a dozen other detectives and friends were there, too. The word had gotten around fast about the suspensions. There was a whole lot of laughter and shouting going on.
"It's a bachelor's party," Samson said, and grinned. "Gotcha, sugar. With a little help from Nana. You should see the look on your face."
For the next hour and a half, friends kept arriving at Hart's. By noon, the bar was full, and then the regular customers started coming in for their lunch hour nips. The owner, Mike Hart, was in his glory. I hadn't really thought about having a bachelor's party, but now that I was in the middle of one, I was glad it happened. A lot of men still guard their emotions and feelings, but not so much at a bachelor's party. At least, not at a good one thrown by the people closest to you. This was a good one. The suspensions that had been handed down earlier that morning were mostly forgotten for a few hours. I was congratulated and hugged more times than I could count, and even kissed once or twice. Everybody was calling me Sugar, following Samson's lead. The love word was used and overused. I was roasted and toasted in sentimental speeches that seemed hilarious at the time. Just about everybody had too much to drink. By 4 in the afternoon, Samson and I were steadying each other, making our way into the blinding daylight on 2nd Street. Mike Hart himself had called us a cab. For a brief, clear moment, I was reminded of the purple and blue gypsy cab we were looking for, but then the thought evaporated into the nearly white sunlight.
"Sugar,"
Samson whispered against my skull as we were climbing into our cab.
"I love you more than life itself. It's true. I love your kids, love your Nana, love your wife-to-be, the lovely Christine."
"Take us home," he said to the driver. "Alex is getting married."
"And he's the best man," I said to the driver, who smiled.
"Yes, I am," said Samson. "The very best."
Chapter 43. On Thursday night, Schaefer played the Four Horsemen again. He was locked inside his study, but through the early part of the night he could hear the sounds of his family throughout the house. He felt intensely isolated. He was nervous, jittery, and angry for no apparent reason. While he waited to log on with the other players, he found himself thinking back to his wild car ride through Washington. He relived a particular feeling over and over, the imagined moment of sudden impact with an unmovable structure. He saw it as blinding light and physical objects, and himself, all shattering like glass and then becoming part of the universe again. Even the pain he would feel would be part of the reassembling of matter into other fascinating forms and shapes.
"I'm suicidal," he finally thought. "It's just a matter of time. I really am death."
When it was exactly 9 o'clock, he began to type in a message on his computer. The other horsemen were online, waiting for his response to the visit and warning by George Bear. He didn't want to disappoint them. What they had done had made him even more enthusiastic about playing the game. He wrote, "Strangely, death wasn't surprised when famine appeared in Washington,
Of course, he had every right to come, just as Death could go to London or Singapore or Manila or Kingston, and perhaps Death will pay one of you a visit soon. That's the beauty of the game we play. Anything can happen. Ultimately, the issue is trust, isn't it? Do I trust that you will allow me to continue to play the fantasy game as I wish? After all, that is what makes the game distinctive and alluring, the freedom we experience. That is the game now, isn't it? We have evolved into something new. We have raised the table stakes. So let's have some real excitement, fellow horsemen. I have a few ideas to try out on you. Everything is in the spirit of the game. No unnecessary risks will be taken. Let's play the game as if our lives depended on it. Perhaps mine already does? As I told you, we have two new players. They are Washington detectives named Alex Cross and John Sampson. Worthy opponents. I'm watching them, but I can't help wondering whether soon they'll be watching me. Let me tell you about a fantasy scenario that I've created to welcome them to our game. I'm sending pictures now. Detectives Cross and Sampson. Chapter 44. It took us a day to get organized for our trip, but everybody seemed to enjoy the spontaneity and also the special treat of our all being together on a vacation for the first time. And so Damon, Jenny, Nana, Christine, and I left D.C. in the afternoon and arrived in high spirits at Bermuda International Airport late on Thursday evening, the 25th of August. I definitely wanted to be out of Washington for a few days. The Mr. Smith murder case had been followed too quickly by the Jane Doe investigation. I needed a rest. I had a friend who was part owner of a hotel in Bermuda, and it wasn't a particularly long airplane ride. It was perfect for us. One scene from the airport will always stick in my mind. Christine's singing Jada Jada with Jenny stuck at her side. I couldn't help thinking that they looked like mother and daughter, and that touched me deeply. They were so affectionate and playful, so natural. It was a mind photo for me to have and to hold, one of those moments that I knew I'd never forget, even as I watched the two of them dancing and singing as if they'd known each other forever. We were blessed with extraordinarily good weather for our holiday. It was sunny and blue-skied every day, morning until nightfall, when the sky turned a magical combination of reds, oranges, and purples. The days belonged to all of us, but especially to the kids. We went swimming and snorkeling at Elbow Beach and Horseshoe Bay, and then raced mopeds along the picturesque Middle and Harbor roads. The nights belonged to Christine and me, and we made the most of them. We had all the best spots, the terrace bar at the Palm Reef, the gazebo lounge at the Princess, the Clay House Inn, Once Upon a Table, in Hamilton, Horizons in Paget. I loved being with her, and that thought kept drifting through my mind. I felt that what we shared had been strengthened because I had backed off and given her time and space, and I felt whole again. I kept remembering the very first time I had seen her in the schoolyard at Sojourner Truth. She's the one, Alex. That thought still played in my head, too. We sat at the terrace bar overlooking the city and harbor of Hamilton. The water was dotted with small islands, white sails, ferries going back and forth to Warwick and Paget. We held hands, and I couldn't stop staring into her eyes. Didn't want to. Big thoughts? She finally asked. I've been thinking a lot about going into private practice again, I told her. I think it might be the best thing to do. She stared into my eyes. I don't want you to do it for me, Alex. Please don't make me the cause of your leaving your job with the police. I know you love it. Most days you do. The job has been tearing at me lately. Pittman isn't just a difficult boss. I think he's a bad guy. What happened to Sampson and the others is just bullshit. They were working unsolved cases on their own time. I'm tempted to give the story to Zach Taylor at the Post. People would riot if they knew the truth, which is why I won't give it to the Post. She listened and tried to help, but she didn't push, and I appreciated that. It does sound like a terrible, complicated, nasty mess, Alex. I'd like to punch out Pittman, too. He's choosing politics over protecting people. I'm sure you'll know what to do when the time is right. The next morning, I found her walking in the garden with tropical flowers strewn in her hair. She looked radiant,
even more than usual, and I fell in love all over again.
There's an old saying I've been hearing since I was a little girl, she told me as I joined her. If you have only 2 pennies, buy a loaf of bread with one and a lily with the other.
I kissed her hair in between the flowers. I kissed her sweet lips, her cheeks, the hollow in her throat.
The kids and I went back to Horseshoe Bay Beach early that afternoon. They couldn't get enough of the deep blue sea, swimming, snorkeling, and building sandcastles. And of course, it was almost time to start school again, so everything about our vacation was extra special and intense. Christine took a moped trip into Hamilton to pick up mementos for a few of the teachers at Sojourner Truth. We all waved until she was out of sight on Middle Road, then back into the water. Around 5 o'clock, Damon, Janney, and I returned to the Belmont Hotel, which sat like a sentinel on lush green hills framed by china blue skies. All around, everywhere we looked, were pastel-colored cottages with white roofs. Nana was sitting out on the porch, talking to a couple of her new best friends. Paradise regained, I thought, and felt something deep and sacred coming back to life inside me. As I stared out at the cloudless blue sky, I regretted that Christine wasn't there to share it. I actually missed her in just that short a time. I hugged Janney and Damon, and we were all smiling at the obvious. We loved being here together, and we were so damn fortunate to have one another.
You miss her?
Janney whispered. It was a statement, not a question.
That's good, Daddy. That's the way it should be, right?
When Christine still hadn't returned by 6 o'clock, I struggled between conflicting thoughts of waiting for her at the hotel or driving into Hamilton myself. Maybe she'd had an accident. Those damn mopeds, I thought, having found them fun and perfectly safe just the afternoon before. I finally spotted a tall, slender woman entering through the front gates of the Belmont, walking against a background of hibiscus and oleander. I sighed with relief, but as I started down the front stairs, I saw that it wasn't Christine. Christine still hadn't returned or called the hotel by 6:30. Or by 7 o'clock. I finally called the police. Chapter 45. Inspector Patrick Busby from the Hamilton PD arrived at the Belmont Hotel around 7:30. He was a small, balding man who, from a distance, looked to be in his late 50s or 60s. As he approached the front porch, though, I could tell he was no more than 40, around the same age as me. He listened to my story, then said that visitors often lost track of time and of themselves in Bermuda. There were also occasional moped accidents on Middle Road. He promised me that Christine would show up soon with a mild road rash or a slightly turned ankle. I wouldn't have any of it. She was always punctual, and at the very least, she would have called. I knew that somehow she'd call if she had a minor accident. So the inspector and I rode together between the hotel and Hamilton, and then we toured the streets of the capital city, particularly Front and Reed Streets. I was silent and solemn-faced as I stared out of the car, hoping to get a glimpse of Christine shopping on some side street, forgetful of the hour. But we didn't see her anywhere, and she still hadn't called the hotel. When she still hadn't turned up by 9, Inspector Busby reluctantly agreed that Christine might be missing. He asked a lot of questions that showed me he was a decent cop. He wanted to know if we'd had any kind of argument or disagreement. I'm a homicide detective in Washington, D.C., I finally told him. I'd been holding it back because I didn't want this to get territorial. I've been involved with high-profile cases involving mass murderers in the past. I've known some very bad men. There might be a connection. I hope not. But that could be.
I see, Busby said.
He was such a precise, neat man with his thin pencil mustache. He looked more like a fussy schoolteacher than a cop. More like a psychologist than I did.
Are there any other surprises I should know about Detective Cross? He asked.
No, that's it. But you see why I'm worried and why I called you. I'm working on a series of nasty murders in Washington right now.
Yes, I see a reason for your concern now. I will put out a missing persons report forthwith.
I sighed heavily, then went upstairs and talked to the kids and Nana. I tried my best not to alarm them, but Damon and Janney started to cry, and then Nana did too.
We had learned nothing more about Christine or her whereabouts by midnight. Inspector Busby left the hotel at 12:15. He was kind, actually, and considerate enough to give me his home number. He asked me to call right away if I heard from Christine. Then he said my family and I would be in his prayers. At 3, I was still up and pacing my hotel room on the 3rd floor and doing some praying myself. I'd just gotten off the phone with Quantico. The FBI was cross-checking all of my homicide cases to see if anyone I'd investigated had any connection with Bermuda. The Bureau was now concentrating on the current series of unsolved murders in Southeast. I'd faxed them my profile on the Weasel. I didn't have any logical reason to suspect that the killer might be here in Bermuda, and yet I feared he might be. It was just the kind of feeling that the Jefe had been rejecting about the murders in Southeast. I understood that the Bureau probably wouldn't get back to me until later in the morning. I was tempted to call friends at Interpol, but I held off. And then I called Interpol, too. The hotel room was filled with mahogany Queen Anne furniture and wicker, and had dusty pink carpets. It seemed empty and lonely. I stood like a ghost before the tall, water-stained dormer windows, stared out at the shifting black shapes against the moonlit sky, and remembered how I held Christine in my arms. I felt incredibly helpless and alone without her. I also couldn't believe this had happened. I hugged myself tightly and became aware of a terrible pain all around my heart. The tightening pain was like a solid column that went from my chest all the way up into my head. I could see her face, her beautiful smile. I remembered dancing with her one night at the Rainbow Room in New York, and dinners at Kincaid's in Washington, and that one special night at her place when we'd laughed and thought maybe we'd made a baby. Was Christine out there somewhere on the island? She had to be. I prayed again that she was safe. She had to be safe. I refused to have any other thought for more than a couple of seconds. The telephone in the room rang, a short burst, at a little past 4 in the morning. My heart was stuck in my throat. My skin crawled, felt as if it were shrinking and no longer fit my body. I rushed across the room and grabbed the phone before the second ring. My hand was trembling. The strange, muffled voice scared me. "You have email." I couldn't think straight. I couldn't think at all. I'd brought my laptop with me on vacation. Who knows that I have my computer here? Who could know a small detail like that about me? Who's been watching me? Watching us? I yanked open the closet door, grabbed the computer, hooked it up, and logged on. I scrolled down the email to the last message. It was short and very concise. "She's safe for now. We have her." The curt, cold message was worse than anything I could imagine. Each word was branded into my brain, repeating over and over. "She's safe for now. We have her." Book 3. Elegy. Chapter 46. Samson arrived at the Belmont Hotel the day after Christine disappeared. I hurried down to the small front lobby to meet him. He threw his large arms around me, clasping me tightly but gently, as if he were holding a child in his arms.
"You okay? You holding up?" he asked.
"Not even close," I told him. "I spent half a day checking the email address I got last night. It came from curtin@mindspring.com. The address was falsified. Nothing is going right."
"We'll get Christine back. We'll find her."
He told me what he knew I wanted to hear, but I was sure that he also truly believed it in his heart. Samson is the most positive human being I've ever met. He won't be denied. "Thanks for coming. It means a lot to all of us. I can't think straight about anything. I'm really rattled, John. I can't even begin to imagine who could have done this. Maybe the Weasel, I don't know."
"If you could think straight now," John said, "I'd be more worried about you than usual. That's why I'm here."
"I kind of knew you'd come."
"Of course you did. I'm Samson. Occam's razor and all that other deep philosophical shit at work here."
There were a half dozen guests in the hotel lobby, and all of them looked our way. The hotel staff knew about Christine's disappearance, and I'm sure that the guests at the Belmont knew as well, as did just about everybody else on the small, chatty island.
The story's on the front page of the local newspaper, Samson said. People were reading copies at the airport. I told him, Bermuda is small, mostly peaceful and orderly. The disappearance of a tourist or any kind of violent crime is unusual here. I don't know how the paper got the story so quickly. The leak must have come out of the police station.
Local police won't help us. Probably get in the way, Samson muttered as we walked over to the hotel registration desk.
He signed in, then we trudged upstairs to show Nana and the kids that Uncle John was here. Chapter 47. The following morning, the two of us met for hours with the police in Hamilton. They were professionals, but a kidnapping was a rarity for them. They let us set up in their station house on Front Street. I still couldn't concentrate or focus the way I needed to. Bermuda is a 21-square-mile island. While the British colony is small, we soon discovered that there are more than 1,200 roads on the island. Samson and I split up and covered as much ground as we possibly could. For the next 2 days, we went from 6 in the morning until 10 or 11 at night without a break. I didn't want to stop, not even to sleep. We didn't do any better than the locals, though. No one had seen anything. We'd reached a dead end. Christine had disappeared without a trace. We were bone-tired. After we finished at the station house on the third night, Samson and I went for a late swim at Elbow Beach, just down the road from the hotel. We had learned to swim at the municipal pool in D.C. Nana had insisted that we learn. She was 54 at the time, and stubborn. She made up her mind to learn and took lessons with us from the Red Cross. The majority of people in Southeast didn't know how to swim back then, and she felt it was symbolic of the limiting inner-city experience. So one summer, Samson and I tackled swimming with Nana at the municipal pool. We went for lessons 3 mornings a week and usually practiced for an extra hour after that. Nana herself was soon able to swim 50 or more laps. She had stamina, same as now. I rarely get into the water without flashing back to those fine summer days of my youth, when I became a reasonably good swimmer. Now, Samson and I floated on the calm surface, out about 100 yards or so from shore. The sky above was the deepest shade of evening blue, sparkling with countless stars. I could see the curving white line of the beach as it stretched several miles in either direction. Palm and casuarina trees shimmied in the sea breeze. I felt devastated, totally overwhelmed as I floated on the sea. I kept seeing Christine with my eyes open or closed. I couldn't believe she was gone. I teared up as I thought about what had happened. The unfairness of life sometimes. You want to talk about the investigation? My thoughts so far? Little things I learned today? Or give it a rest for the night? Samson asked me as we floated peacefully on our backs. Talk or quiet time? Talk, I guess. I can't think about anything else except Christine. I can't think straight. Say whatever you're thinking. Something bothering you in particular? Little thing, but maybe it's important. I didn't say anything. I just let him go on. What puzzles me is the first newspaper stories. Samson paused and then continued. Busby says he didn't talk to anybody the first night. Not a single person, he claims. You didn't either. Story was in the morning edition, though. It's a small island, John. I told you that, and you've seen it yourself. But Samson kept at it, and I began to think that maybe there was something to it. Listen, Alex. Only you, Patrick Busby, and whoever took Christine knew. He called it into the paper. The kidnapper did it himself. I talked to the girl at the paper who got the call. She wouldn't say anything yesterday, but she finally told me late today. She thought it was just a concerned citizen calling. I think somebody's playing with your head, Alex. Somebody's running a nasty game on you.
We have her. A game? What kind of nasty game? Who were the nasty players? Was one of them the weasel? Was it possible that he was still here in Bermuda?
Chapter 48. I couldn't sleep back at the hotel. I still couldn't concentrate or focus, and it was incredibly frustrating. It was as if I were losing my mind. A game? No, this wasn't a game. This was shock and horror.
This was a living nightmare beyond anything I had ever experienced. Who could have done this to Christine? Why? Who was the weasel? Every time I closed my eyes, tried to sleep, I could see Christine's face. See her waving goodbye that final time on Middle Road. See her walking through the hotel gardens with flowers in her hair. I could hear Christine's voice all through the night. And then it was morning again. My guilt over what had happened to her had doubled, tripled. Samson and I continued to canvass Middle Road, Harbor Road, South Road. Every person we spoke to in the police and the military believed that Christine didn't simply disappear on the island. Samson and I heard the same song and dance every day for a week. No shopkeepers or taxi or bus drivers had seen her in Hamilton or St. George, so it was possible that she'd never even arrived in either town that afternoon. No one, not one witness, remembered seeing her moped on Middle or Harbor roads, so maybe she never even got that far. Most disturbing of all was that there hadn't been any further communication with me about her since the email on the night she disappeared. An agent at the FBI had investigated the email address and found it didn't exist. Whoever had contacted me was a skillful hacker, able to conceal his or her identity. The words I'd read that night were always on my mind. She's safe for now. We have her. Who was we? And why hadn't there been any further contact? What did they want from me? Did they know they were driving me insane? Was that what they wanted to do? Did the weasel represent more than one killer? Suddenly that made a lot of sense to me. Samson returned to Washington on Sunday, and he took Nana and the kids with him. They didn't want to leave without me, but it was time for them to go. I couldn't make myself leave Bermuda yet. It would have felt as if I were abandoning Christine. On Sunday night, Patrick Busby showed up at the Belmont Hotel around 9. He asked me to ride with him out past Southampton, about a 6-mile drive that he said would take us 20 minutes or more. Bermudians measure distances in straight lines, but all the roads run in wiggles and half circles, so it always takes longer to travel than you might think. "What is it, Patrick? What's out in Southampton?" I asked as we rode along Middle Road. My heart was in my throat. He was scaring me with his silence.
"We haven't found Mrs. Johnson. However, a man may have witnessed the abduction. I want you to hear his story. You decide for yourself. You're the big city detective, not me. You can ask whatever questions you like. Off the record, of course."
The man's name was Perry Graham, and he was staying in a room at the Port Royal Golf Club. We met him at his tiny apartment in the staff quarters. He was tall and painfully thin, with a longish goatee. He clearly wasn't happy to see Inspector Busby or me on his doorstep. Busby had already told me that Graham was originally from London and now worked as a porter and maintenance man at the semi-private golf club. He had also lived in New York City and Miami and had a criminal record for selling crack in New York.
"Already told him everything I saw,"
Perry Graham said defensively as soon as he opened the front door of his room and saw the two of us standing there.
"Go away. Let me be. Why would I hold back anything or—"
I cut him off. "My name is Alex Cross. I'm a homicide detective from Washington. The woman you saw was my fiancée, Mr. Graham. May we come in and talk? This will only take a few minutes." He shook his head back and forth in frustration.
"I'll tell you what I know. Again," he finally said, relenting. "Yeah, come in. But only because you called me Mr. Graham."
"That's all I want. I'm not here to bother you about anything else." Busby and I walked inside the room, which was little more than an alcove. The tile floors and all the furniture were strewn with wrinkled clothes, mostly underwear.
"A woman I know lives in Hamilton," Graham said in a weary voice. "I went to visit her this Tuesday past. We drank too much wine. Stayed the evening. You know how it is. I got up somehow. Had to be at the club by noon, but I knew I'd be late and get docked some of my pay. Don't have a car or nothing. So I hitched a ride from Hamilton, out South Shore Road. Walked along near Paget, I suppose. Damn hot afternoon, I remember. I went down to the water, cool off if I could. I came back up over a knobbly hill, and I witnessed an accident on the roadway. It was maybe a quarter of a mile down the big hill there. You know it?
I nodded and held my breath as I listened to him. I remembered the stifling heat of that afternoon, everything about it. I could still see Christine driving off in a shiny blue moped, waving and smiling. The memory of her smile, which had always brought me such joy, now put a tight knot in my stomach.
I saw a white van hit a woman riding a blue moped. I can't be sure, but it almost looked like the van hit her on purpose. Driver, he jumped out of the van right away and helped her up. She didn't look like she was hurt badly. Then he helped her inside the van. Put the moped inside, too. Then he drove off. I thought he was taking her to hospital. Thought nothing else of it.
You sure she wasn't badly hurt? I asked.
Not sure, but she got right up. She was able to stand all right.
There was a catch in my voice when I spoke again. And you didn't tell anybody about the accident? Not even when you saw the news stories? The man shook his head.
Didn't see no stories. Don't bother with the local news much. Just small-time shit and worthless gossip. But then me girl, she kept talking about it. I didn't want to go to the police, but she made me do it. Made me talk to this inspector here.
You know what kind of van it was? I asked.
White van. I think it was maybe a rented one. Clean and new.
License plate? Graham shook his head.
Don't have no idea.
What did the man in the van look like? I asked him. Any little thing you remember is helpful, Mr. Graham. You've already helped a lot. He shrugged, but I could tell that he was trying to think back to that afternoon.
Nothing special about him. Not as tall as you, but tall. Looked like anybody else. Just a black man, like any other.
Chapter 49. In a small apartment in a suburb of Washington called Mount Rainier, Detective Patsy Hampton lay in bed, restlessly flipping through the pages of the Post. She couldn't sleep, but there was nothing unusual about that. She often had trouble sleeping, ever since she was a little girl in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Her mother said she must have a guilty conscience about something. She watched a rerun episode of ER, then fetched herself a Stonyfield yogurt with blueberries, and logged on to America Online. She had email from her father, now relocated in Delray Beach, Florida, and one from an old college roommate from the University of Richmond, whom she had never been that close to anyway. The roommate had just heard from a mutual friend that Patsy was a hotshot police detective in Washington, and what an exciting life she must lead. The roommate wrote that she had four children and lived in a suburb of Charlotte, North Carolina, but added that she was bored with everything in her life. Patsy Hampton would have given anything to have just one child. She wandered back to the kitchen and got a cold bottle of Evian mineral water. She was aware that her life had become ridiculous lately. She spent too much time on her job, but also too much time by herself in her apartment, especially on weekends. It wasn't that she couldn't get dates. She was just turned off by men in general. She still fantasized about finding someone compatible, having children, but she was increasingly tired of the depressing and maddening cycle of trying to meet someone interesting. She usually ended up with guys who were either hopelessly boring or 30-something jackasses who still acted like teenagers, though without the charm of youth. Hopeless, 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 she thought, as she sent off a cheery lie to her dad in Florida. The phone rang, and she glanced at her wristwatch. It was 12:20. She snatched up the receiver.
Hampton speaking. It's Chuck, Patsy. Really sorry to call so late. Is it okay? You awake?
Sure. No problem, Chuck E. Cheese. I'm up with the other vampires. Yourself included, I guess.
It was kind of late, but she was glad to hear from Chuck Hufstedler, who was a computer geek at the FBI in Washington. The two of them helped each other out sometimes, and she'd recently talked to him about the unsolved D.C. murders, especially the Jane Does. Chuck had told her that he was also in contact with Alex Cross, but Cross had trouble of his own right now. His fiancée had been kidnapped, and Patsy Hampton wondered if it had anything to do with the killings in Southeast.
I'm wide awake, Chuck. What's up? What's on your big mind?
He started with a disclaimer that said volumes about his incredibly low self-esteem.
Maybe nothing, but maybe something a little interesting on those killings in Southeast, and particularly the two young girls in Shaw. This really comes out of left field, though.
The FBI computer expert had her attention. That's where the killer lives, Chuck, in deep left field. Tell me what you have. I'm wide awake and listening. Talk to me, Chuck E. Cheese. Chuck hemmed and hawed. He was always like that, which was too bad because he was basically a really nice guy.
You know anything about RPGs, Patsy?
He asked. I know it stands for role-playing games, and let's see, there's a popular one called Dragons and Dungeons, or Dungeons and Dragons, whatever the order. It's Dungeons and Dragons, or Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. Confession time, kiddo. I occasionally play an RPG myself. It's called Millennium's End. I play a couple of hours a day, usually, more on weekends.
New to me. Go on, Chuck.
God, she thought, cyberspace confessions in the middle of the night.
Very popular game, even with so-called adults. The characters in Millennium's End work for Black Eagle Security. It's a private organization of troubleshooters who hire out for investigative services around the world. The characters are all good guys, crusaders for good.
Chuck. Say six Hail Marys, now make an act of contrition. Then get to the damn point. It is around 12:30, pal.
Right. I am heartily sorry and deeply embarrassed, too. Anyway, there's a chat room online that I visited. It's called the Gamester's Chat Room. It's on AOL. As I speak, there's a fascinating discussion going on about a new kind of game. It's more an anti-game, though. All the role-playing games I know are about good characters trying to conquer chaos and evil. The game under discussion has a couple of evil characters trying to overcome good. Specifically, Patsy, one of the characters is attacking and murdering women in the southeast part of D.C. Lots of lurid detail on the murders. These aren't the actual players, but they know about the game. The game itself is probably protected. Thought you should know. The game is called The Four Horsemen.
Patsy Hampton was definitely wide awake now.
I'm on it. Thanks, Chuck. Let's keep this between the two of us for the moment, okay, Chuck?
Yeah. Okay. It took her a couple of minutes to log on to AOL, then get into the Gamester's chat room. She didn't participate, just read what the others had to say. This was interesting. She wondered if she had just stumbled onto her first big break in the Jane Doe case. The others in the room were named Viper, Landlocked, J-Boy, and Lancelot. They chattered on and on about the hottest fantasy games and cutting-edge magazines, which nearly succeeded in putting her to sleep. The Four Horsemen came up twice, but only in passing, as a point of reference. Lancelot was the one who mentioned it. Chuck was right. These probably weren't the actual players, but they knew about the game somehow. The fantasy nerds were starting to wear really thin with her by 1:15. Finally, out of frustration, she typed out a message for the little shitheels. She called herself Sappho.
I came in late, but Horseman sounds like a neat kind of revolutionary game to me, Lancelot.
Pretty audacious stuff, no? Lancelot shot back.
Not really, Sappho. There's a lot of it going around lately. Anti-heroes, sickos, especially in vampire game circles.
Hampton typed.
Haven't I read about murders like these in the newspapers? By the way, it's Sappho, like the poet.
Lancelot replied,
Yeah, but lots of RPGs use current events. No biggie, really, Sappho.
Hampton grinned. He was an obnoxious little nerd, but she had him, for the moment anyway, and she needed him. How much did he know about the Four Horsemen? Could he be a player? She tried to peek at Lancelot's profile, but he had restricted access to it.
You're funny. Are you a player laugh-a-lot, or just an art critic?
I don't like the basic concept of horsemen. Anyway, it's a private game. Strictly private. Encrypted.
You know any of the players? I might like to try it out myself.
There was no response to the question. Patsy thought maybe she'd pushed too hard too fast.
Damn.
She should have known better.
Damn, damn.
Come back, Lancelot. Earth to Lancelot.
I really would like to play the Four Horsemen. But I'm cool about it. No biggie.
Lancelot? Patsy Hampton waited, and then Lancelot left the chat room. Lancelot was gone. and so was her connection to somebody playing a so-called fantasy game about committing gruesome murders in Washington. Murders that had really happened. Chapter 50.
I returned to Washington during the first week of September, and I had never felt stranger in my own skin. I'd gone to Bermuda with my family and Christine, and now I was coming home without her. Whoever had taken Christine had contacted me only once. I missed her nearly every moment of every day, and it pained me to think about where she might still be. It was an unusually cool and windy day when I got back to the city. It almost seemed as if summer had suddenly changed to the middle of fall, as if I had been away much longer than I had. I had been in a fog of unreality in Bermuda, and it was nearly the same once I was back in D.C. It had never been this bad before. I was so lost, so unhinged, so battered. I wondered if Christine and I were part of a madman's elaborate delusion, what profilers call an escalating fantasy. If so, who was this madman? And where was he now? Was it the Weasel? Did I know him from some time in my past? The heartless, spineless bastard had communicated, "We have her." And that was it. No further word. Now only silence, which was deafening. I took a cab from the airport and remembered what had happened to Frank Odenkirk, who had innocently taken a cab one night in August and wound up murdered on Alabama Avenue near DuPont Park. I hadn't thought about the Odenkirk case during the past 3 weeks. I had rarely even had a thought about the Jane Doe murders while in Bermuda, but I was guiltily reminded of them now. Others had suffered painful losses because of the killer. I wondered if any progress had been made, and who in the department was running the case, or at least the Odenkirk part of it. On the other hand, I didn't feel that I could work on any of the other unsolved murders right now. I felt my place was still in Bermuda, and I nearly headed back as soon as I landed. Then I could see our house up ahead on Fifth Street. Something strange was happening. There was a huge gathering. Chapter 51. Lots of people were standing on the porch, and others were clustered in front of the house when the cab arrived. Cars were parked and double-parked all along the street. I recognized Aunt Tia, my sister-in-law Scylla, and Nana were on the porch with the kids. Samson was there with a girlfriend named Millie, a lawyer from the Justice Department. Some of them waved as I pulled up, so I knew everything was all right. This wasn't more trouble. But what was this all about? I saw my niece Naomi and her husband Seth Taylor, who had come all the way from Durham, North Carolina. Jerome Thurman, Rakeem Powell, and Sean Moore were standing on the front lawn.
"Hey, Alex, good to see you," Jerome's deep voice boomed out at me as I passed near him on my way to the porch.
I finally set down my travel bag and started shaking hands, giving out hugs, receiving back pats and kisses from all sides.
"We're all here for you," Naomi said.
She came over to me and hugged me tightly.
"We love you so much. But we'll go away if you don't want us here now."
"No, no. I'm glad you're here, Scoochie," I said, and kissed my niece on both cheeks. A while back, she'd been abducted in Durham, North Carolina. I had been there for her, and so had Samson. "It's good to see that you and Seth are here. It's good to see everybody. You can't imagine how good it is." I hugged relatives and friends, my grandmother, my two beautiful kids, and I realized again how lucky I was to have so many good people in my life. Two teachers from the Sojourner Truth School had also come to the house. They were friends of Christine's, and they started to cry when they came up to me. They wanted to know if any progress had been made, and if there was anything they could do. I told them that we had a witness to the abduction, and that we were more hopeful than ever. The teachers were buoyed by the news, which wasn't nearly as good as I made it sound. Nothing more had come of the one eyewitness account of the abduction. No one else had seen the white van that took away Christine. Janny cornered me in the backyard around 9 o'clock. I had just spent half an hour with Damon in the basement, talking man-to-man, shadowboxing a little bit. Damon had told me that he was having trouble remembering Christine's face, exactly what she looked like. I told him that happened with people, and that it was all right. Then we shared a long hug. Janny had patiently waited to talk with me.
"My turn?" she asked.
"Absolutely, sweetheart." Janny then took my hand and pulled me forward into the house.
She quietly led me upstairs, not to her room, but to mine.
If you get lonely in here tonight, you can come to my room. I mean it, she said as she gently shut the door on the two of us.
She is so wise and has such a good perspective on so many things. Both she and Damon are such good kids. Nana says they have sound character, and it is building nicely. So far, so good. Thank you, sweetie. I will come to your room if it gets bad in here. You're very thoughtful and nice.
I am, Daddy. You helped me be this way, and I'm glad of it. Now I have a real serious question for you, Daddy. It's hard, but I have to ask anyway.
You go ahead, I told her, feeling uncomfortable under her serious little gaze. I wasn't completely focused, and I didn't know if I could handle one of Janny's hard questions. I'm listening, sweetheart, I said. Fire away. She had let go of my hand, but then she took it up again, held my big hand tightly in both her small ones.
Daddy, is Christine dead? She asked me. You can tell me if she is. Please tell the true truth, though. I want to know.
I almost lost it, sitting on the edge of the bed with Janny. I'm sure she had no idea how much her question hurt or how hard it was to answer. I was hanging over the edge of a dark abyss, just about gone. But I pulled myself together and took a deep, hard breath. Then I tried to answer my little girl's honest question as best I could. I don't know yet, I told her. That's the truth. We're still hoping to find her, sweetie. We found one witness so far.
But she might be dead, Daddy.
Let me tell you the best thing I know about dying, I said to Jenny. The very best thing that I know. Just about the only thing, in fact.
You go away, and then you're with Jesus forever, Janny said.
The way she spoke, though, I wasn't sure if she really believed what she was saying. It sounded like one of Nana's gospel truths, or maybe she'd heard it in church. Yes, that can be a great comfort to know, baby. But I was thinking of something else. Maybe it's the same thing, but a different way to look at it. Her intense little eyes held mine, wouldn't let go.
You can tell me, Daddy. Please. I want to hear it. I'm very interested in this.
It's not a bad thing, but it helps me whenever somebody dies. Think about this. We come into life so easily, from somewhere, from the universe, from God. Why should it be any harder when we leave life? We come from a good place, we leave, and go to a good place. Does that make any sense to you, Jenny? She nodded and continued to stare deeply into my eyes.
I understand, she whispered. It's like it's in balance.
She paused a second, thinking it over, then she spoke.
But, Daddy, Christine isn't dead. I just know it. She isn't dead. She hasn't gone to that good place yet. So don't you lose hope.
Chapter 52. The character and traits of death were so much like his own, Schaefer was thinking as he sped south along I-95. Death wasn't brilliant, but he was always thorough, and he always won in the end. As the Black Jag raced past the exits for various small towns, Schaefer wondered if he wanted to be caught now, if he needed to be unmasked, needed to show his true face to everyone. Boo Cassidy believed that he was hiding, even from her, but more important, from himself. Maybe she was right. Maybe he did want Lucy and the kids to see who he really was, and the police. But especially the uptight and sanctimonious staff at the embassy.
I am death. It's who I am. I'm a multiple killer. It's who I am. I am not Jeffrey Schaefer anymore. Maybe I never was. But if I was, it was a long, long time ago.
Schaefer had always had a natural mean streak, a vengeful, nasty way.
He remembered it from his early years traveling with his family through Europe, then Asia, and finally back to England. His father had been in the military and was always a real tough guy around the house. He struck Schaefer and his two brothers often, but not nearly as often as he hit their mother, who died of a fall when Schaefer was 12. Schaefer was large as a boy, and he was one tough hombre, a real bully. Other boys feared him, even his brothers Charles and George, who believed that Jeff was capable of anything. He was. Nothing in his early days prepared him for being the man who finally emerged once he joined MI6. It was there that he learned he was capable of killing another human being, and he found that he loved it. He had discovered his calling, his true passion in life. He was the ultimate tough guy. He was death. He continued traveling south on the interstate highway. Because it was late, traffic was light, mostly high-speeding trucks headed toward Florida, he supposed. He mentally composed a message to the other fantasy game players. Death goes to Fredericksburg, Virginia tonight. A good-looking 37-year-old woman lives there with her mirror-image 15-year-old daughter. The woman is divorced, a small-town lawyer, a prosecutor. The daughter is an honor student and a football cheerleader. The two women will be sleeping. Death has come to Virginia because Washington is too dangerous now. Yes, I took your warning to heart. The D.C. police are searching for the Jane Doe murderer. A well-thought-of detective named Patsy Hampton is on the case. And Detective Cross has returned from Bermuda. It will be interesting to see if his character has changed in any way. Character is everything, don't you agree? I can see the Cahill house up ahead. I can picture both of the lovely Cahill women. They live in a four-bedroom ranch house. The suburban street is virtually silent at 1 a.m. No one could possibly connect these two murders to the Jane Does. I wish you could be here with me. I wish you could feel exactly as I do.
This book is continued on Disc 5.